One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
This is a podcast from The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
The Rugby World Cup from The Times. With Mark Suster.
We'll be with you every week with the latest from the tournament, looking at the prospects for the home nations and the other big guns, of course, and reviewing all the action on and off the field.
Find it at thetimes.co.uk or in iTunes.
Welcome to the Game Podcast, the Ding Dong Derby of Football Podcast. Today I'm joined by Ollie Kay, Tony Evans, and Matt Dickinson. Later on, we'll be asking what's next for Carlos Tevez, but let's crack on with all our local rivalries. And let's start in North London. Spurs defeat Arsenal 2-1. Big deal. Certainly feels like a big deal here in London. Feels like a big derby. I'm just wondering, is there a broader message here? And I want to start with you, Ollie. Because, you know, you write about the disparities behind those teams, real or perceived. Are Spurs actually ahead of Arsenal?
Well, I mean, how many points behind them did they finish last season? And I mean, it can't have been many. I haven't got the table in front of me, but it wasn't much in the end. You look at the summer and Arsenal look weaker and Spurs ultimately strengthened, and you think, well, look at the way they've both started. Spurs, you know, they both started poorly in August, but Spurs have bounced back with four wins in a row and look solid and look positive and dynamic. And Arsenal, I mean, you know, there was once a huge, huge gap between them, even as recently as 2 or 3 years ago, and it just isn't there now.
Well, Dicko, if I was to play devil's advocate with what Ollie just said, I could point out that everybody's injured for Arsenal right now, whereas Spurs, with the exception of Dawson, this is pretty much it. And that, yeah, over the 90 minutes, Spurs won 2-1 because they scored a goal after Rafael van der Vaart handled the ball. And then Kyle Walker hits a belter, which could go anywhere, and Chesney misjudges that. Is that the world view through Arsenal-tinted glasses?
Well, I mean, Arsenal are not as bad as their league plays suggest. They're not as bad as their form suggests. They're not as bad as everything suggests. But, you know, even when they have their players back, you're putting an awful lot of strain on Jack Wilshere. You know, he will return with just this colossal burden, you know, and we don't even know when that's going to be yet. And, you know, they've got a couple of defenders to come back, but then now they've lost Sanya. The trouble is that even with their strongest team, you can still see issues of leadership, issues of age profile in the team, issues of did they actually sign the right players, you know, in at the end of that transfer window when they appear to be scrambling, you know, rather unconvincingly and uncharacteristically. So, look, you know, they're better than this, you know, but they've dug a deep hole for themselves, and it's going to take a while to get out of it.
I've got to say, I look at them and I think they're in a real mess. And they're a lot of good players, you know, you can't deny that. But, you know, and they've got injuries, but you looked at them yesterday, and while they played well in spells, they were still all over the place. You know, they bought badly during the summer. You know, it's you buy a big German defender, and they've bought the worst one they could have by the looks of it. You know, using Arteta as the deep line midfielder yesterday, what was that all about? You know, the sense of purpose seems to be lost at Arsenal. You know, they don't seem to be going in any sort of direction. And while I don't think Tottenham particularly strengthened during the summer, they've not gone backwards. Arsenal is sliding backwards.
couple of, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, because they tactically yesterday, I mean, a lot of people have, you know, defending Arsenal have made the point that they did outman them in midfield and for long periods outplay the midfield. But then you can twist it the other way and say that Redknapp was willing to play the two strikers and risk that because he knows that the defence is you know, Arsenal's defence is so vulnerable, you can actually take that risk against them. And that's the trouble for Arsenal. People know with that defensive weakness that you can actually take a risk about being outpassed by them because you're gonna outscore them. And that's a real difficult situation for Wenger to be in when teams can actually just say, you know, hey, we're just going to go at you because we think you're going to crack.
6 or 7 years ago, they passed with a purpose. They were going forward, you know, and they'd use the ball, they'd get up to the opposition penalty area and they'd score. Now it seems to be around the midfield and too often they're giving the ball away in those areas where people hurt them.
Yeah, on that point, actually, Tony, I thought Theo Walcott was absolutely atrocious yesterday. And I've come around to the idea that this guy's not going to improve and he's not a good fit for the way Wenger plays. And maybe if Wenger leaves under different managers, maybe Walcott can do well. Am I being exceedingly hard on Theo?
I don't think so. I mean, clearly he's got something. He's got his pace.
Yeah, if Abu Dhabi were fit, or any old schlub like that, when you play him instead of Abu Dhabi, by the way, who the world seems to have forgotten, but I thought actually has some skills. When you play those guys ahead of Walcott, what does this guy do?
I would.
Well, Theo's potentially an excellent player for Arsenal and does fit their pattern. I think it simply comes down to an issue of confidence.
How does he fit the pattern if he's not aware of the people around him and he makes the wrong runs at the wrong time?
I don't think that's his issue. I think his issue, and it's always been the case with Theo, is a matter of assertiveness. I don't think I don't judge him yesterday on whether he makes the right runs or not. I was looking at him and just sighing because he'd gone back into a shell, and I've always thought with him that it is 90% an issue, whether he plays well or not, whether he's under the form or not, is of assertiveness, and when he loses it and when he lacks it, you see him, as with yesterday, drift through a game anonymously, and the mystery of when he gets it and when he doesn't is all in his head, I'm afraid.
Yeah, when he starts thinking, his game goes out the window.
I would say that, I mean, he doesn't really fit into Arsenal's style at all, except when you look at him as the outlet, the guy that gives them something that they don't otherwise have, the pace, the directness, the penetrative runs. In that respect, he's ideal for them. But, you know, when he's talking about wanting to be a striker, saying, I'm not a winger, I want to play through the middle, you're certainly not going to play him as the lone striker. Are you going to go to 4-4-2 just so that you can accommodate Walcott up front? I don't think so, looking at Arsenal's players. And also, if you look at the type of player he is, he's just not suited to being a striker, I don't think. Certainly not in a team that relies as much on sort of clever, intelligent build-up play and thought and movement as Arsenal do. I think he needs to realise his best chance of making it at the top level is as a winger, and he needs to sort of re-educate himself in what being a top-class winger is. And assertiveness would certainly help as well, but I think there's elements of decision making and intelligence that he lacks.
And basically, he needs to be taught how to cross the ball.
I want to get your sense on this version of 4-4-2 that Redknapp played. It's the kind of thing that some of us, and I'll hold my hand up, thought, all right, you know, this is just too imbalanced. Van der Vaart, Modric, and Bale, plus the two strikers, one of the two being Defoe. You know, you can get completely overrun, but I think as somebody made the point earlier, it did work. Is this something that he can build on, this formation, or is it unrealistic? Especially, you know, will it be unrealistic when King gets hurt again?
I mean, I thought it he sort of got away with it because you know, say it was a sort of calculated risk. I mean, there's, you know, clearly in the second half when they were being, particularly when the first 20 minutes, second half being overrun, and Redknapp said afterwards that's when he had to take mistake. Van der Vaart was to blame for Arsenal's equaliser because he just let Son go completely round the back without even bothering to stick in a tackle. That's obviously the downside of playing that team. So it's not a team you play in every game. It's a team that can be overrun, and Arsenal did threaten to do that for 20 minutes, and that's why he brought on Sandro and stiffened it up. And I guess the great thing for Spurs fans is that they have the option to do both. That's, you know, they got Sandro, who's really, you know, coming on as a very promising player. So, you know, he can be attacking or less so to fit the game in the opposition.
Like all good derbies, there was controversy and off the pitch stuff. I want to start with you, Ollie, because you've written recently about some of the ugly songs and tasteless abuse that gets thrown up sometimes, whether it's Hillsborough or Munich. Here, big deal was made of some Arsenal fans singing Adebayor a song about how he should have been the one who was shot in Angola. Somebody pointed out that prompted the usual song about Arsene Wenger from the other end. Is this comparable to the Hillsborough Munich stuff in the sense that it's directed at a single person? I mean, I'm not asking you to make a value judgment about, oh, one's better, one's worse, but was it that noticeable?
Oh, well, it was certainly noticeable. I mean, it was you know, very audible from wherever you were in the ground, I should think, certainly from where we were in the press box, which is probably about 60, 70 yards away from the Arsenal fans. I mean, I don't think we should get into sort of making value judgments, as you say, on what's worse. I think it's all part of the same culture of you know, how low can we go in order to antagonise the opposition. And you know, I'm sure people will make a defence of that, saying, well, it's only banter in the course of a football match, and the tribalism of that. But I mean, to trivialise what Adebayor and his Togo teammates went through in Angola that day, and to mock it, I think is as low as anything. And it's I'm not a fan of it, as you well know.
Tony, maybe you can give us some insight. Who sits in a pub and sort of
why
works out?
Why can Tony give you the invite? Why is Tony better qualified than you?
I mean,
I did it at Cambridge United, and that was about seven of us singing. I want to know how you get a chance like this to spread around the entire Kop End.
It's strange because they just happen, don't they? You know, it's who sits and comes up with them, I'll never know. I mean, maybe there's, you know, the evil genius songwriting agency where you know, they come up with these. You know, it's just they spread, and you know, the thing is, I mean, I think many of us have done it when we were young and stupid, you know, and you kind of, you know, I'm almost willing to let it go. But when you see fully grown middle-aged men doing it, you think, you know, you just think to yourself, you know, football leads people to be deranged, and you know, and they need, frankly,
middle-aged women's even worse.
Well, yeah, you know. So,
speaking of a deranged, I judge from the reaction in the Twitter sphere that Clive Allen reacted like a man deranged when Arsene Wenger didn't shake his hand at the final whistle. Now, for those who don't know who Clive Allen is, and I'm suggesting that perhaps Arsene Wenger might not know since he blanked him, Clive Allen is an assistant coach at Spurs and a former Tottenham striker.
Clive Allen played in France, of course.
I'm sorry?
Clive Allen played in France when Wenger was at Monaco, so he will know him well.
Yes, I'm sure Arsene Wenger knew all 450-odd players in the Ligue 1 back then on an intimate basis, but
Clive Allen was an internationally renowned goal scorer.
Enough with the Clive Allen, please. This is all for the benefit of you guys sucking up to Chris, the producer here, who's a notorious Tottenham fan. But my point here is obviously Arsene Wenger knows who the guy is. Clive Allen goes up to him, shakes his hand. I thought Wenger's defense, I want to come to you, Dicko, because you wrote about this, it was interesting. He said, how many of these freaking Spurs guys how many hands do I need to shake? You know, I shook Redknapp's hand, I shook Kevin Bond's hand. Now this guy comes up, he wants to shake my hand too. Does Wenger have a point that, you know, yeah, it's great, the handshaking tradition and whatever else, but you know, I'd love to know what did this happen in previous derbies, or it was Clive Allen? Do you think it was Clive Allen the kind of guy who would want to rub it in that way?
Well, if we're going to on the actual issue of how many hands you should shake, I mean, if we're daft enough to have to have rules about whether you can take your shirt off to celebrate, then maybe we should start having a rule about how many hands should be shaken as well. But I think ultimately it looked like Clive Allen was after a headline. He was a man chasing after Wenger and chasing after a fight and a story. He acted like a bit of a pillock, to be honest. Now, you know, Wenger can be the most peevish man on earth, particularly when he's lost, and particularly when he's lost. His local rivals and is in the mess he's in. But Clive Allen was just acting like a bit of a prat, to be honest. And I think that's pretty universally shared among my colleagues in the press box.
Anybody want to stick up for Clive Allen except for you, Chris?
No, I think the point Dicko made in his piece where he said, "Can I quote you, Dicko? He said that we were left with the sight of this great man of football, that's Wenger, being wound up by someone as irrelevant to him as Redknapp's assistant, which I think sums that up for me.
Moving on to Goodison for what was once described as the friendly derby. Liverpool coming out top again. This was a game that was obviously radically changed in the 23rd minute. I thought early on, you had all the ingredients that I know it seems like a stereotype, but that you expect, and people flying into tackles, and two teams very committed, and so on. Then in the 23rd minute, it happens. I'm going to start with you, Tony, for obvious reasons. You probably have a greater emotional investment here than anybody else, but Jack Rodwell goes in on Luis Suarez, Martin Atkinson standing right there. We can get this out of the way. This was Martin Atkinson made an honest mistake there, right?
Well, you know, I wouldn't have sent him off. But let's get it in perspective here. Right. In the modern game, in the old days, you used to be able to win the ball, go through a man, and get away with it. I got the ball first, was the catch-all, you know, It excused any crime. The fact is, Rodwell made a stupid challenge. He dived in the halfway line thinking, I'll get the ball, I'll give him a whack. It's, you know, it's right by the centre circle, won't be an issue. And what he did is he gave the referee the chance to make a mistake. You know what? If I would have been David Moyes, I would have been as mad at the player as I would have been at the referee. Stupid, unnecessary, and it did change the game.
Any dissent from the masses here?
I would agree with Tony on the thing about the rules having changed and the fact that getting the ball is no longer a relevant argument if you follow through and get the man. But it just was not a red card challenge. We can say that he gave Atkinson the opportunity, but it was an opportunity that 99 refs out of 100 wouldn't have taken 99 times out of 100. You just never ever see sendings off or things like that. And then you see the challenges from Fellaini, Cahill,
Hibbert
later in the game, and they were all worse challenges in a way. But I think he made a big rod for his own back and didn't know what to do with it. And it was a bizarre decision. I mean, the getting the ball issue is spurious in a way, but it just was not a red card.
Presumably, it's interesting to see Kenny Dalglish, who's been railing against obviously refereeing decisions and saying what a terrible time they have, suddenly saying, well, it's the rules of the rules and you've got to go along with it. So,
he also said he didn't see it.
All right, that's enough criticism of Dalglish for the year on this program, please. No more. But I want to get back, because, I mean, sometimes we're critical of referees. I think the guy made a mistake. You know, it happens. Strikers miss open goals. But what concerns me a little bit is how a decision, and what I thought was interesting, a decision like that can affect the flow of the rest of the game. Because almost immediately afterwards, Cahill went in on somebody. In fact, I think he basically just assaulted a Liverpool player. I forget which one. And he got away with it. And to me, the mentality is very simple. Cahill's thinking, oh, look, he just sent Rodwell off. Well, surely he's not going to send me off. So I'm just going to karate kick whichever Liverpool defender it was in the throat. And it kind of sets a tone for this. And then I almost thought like Liverpool going on eggshells because they're thinking like, ooh, you know, would Atkinson have seen it at halftime with one of his assistants that told him, you know, is he going to even things out? And to his credit, Atkinson didn't. And I think it's difficult for a referee, but I think you have to have the guts that if you made a mistake and people tell you you made a mistake and you know you made a mistake, well, you know, you can't go back and even things out. But I don't want to use the word spoil the game for obvious reasons, but it did seem like it was a completely different match after the red card, wasn't it, Tony?
Well, yeah, but I mean, you know, in my view, the responsibility of referees, one of the responsibilities should be to keep the 11 aside as much as they can. So, yeah, it did spoil the game, it changed the game. I mean, as it happens, it was a pretty tight game, you know, as derbies often are.
And see, I would have sent off Cahill and allowed Rodwell back on if the rules allowed that.
Well, yeah, I'd send off Cahill every time he plays. Because he's that sort of player.
Is he the new Dennis Wise in your mind?
Oh, he's even worse than Dennis Wise. He's the Australian Dennis Wise. How bad's that?
There you go. Dicko, the really good news for Liverpool, apart from the 3 points, is that Andy Carroll scores. And it can only be a positive. I thought, you know, he worked hard. He put himself around the pitch. My one thing I want to throw to you, though, is that is it going to be challenging for Dalglish to find the best way to use him? Because I thought when Carroll's out there being so dominant, you lost a little bit of Liverpool's passing.
Well, I think that is the challenge. I mean, well, there's quite a few challenges. Obviously, when Gerrard is fit again, just how he meshes this all together. I mean, I see, you know, Tony Barrett gave Carroll 5 out of 10, you know, despite obviously the impact of the goal and, as you say, the dominance. So, and I think that's a fair mark. I mean, I think it was better than we've seen before, and obviously a bit more positive, but it was by, you know, a long way from being, you know, that's it, we've cracked it, and this is the best team.
I remember. Wait, so you punish Carroll because you don't like the type of service he gets?
I think what you've got, you know, you've got an issue, and you sort of brought it up in the question. Is that I remember watching him for England once when Carroll was playing, and you literally did see players sort of shaping, you know, and obviously they're trying to play to Carroll's strengths, but suddenly they were looking for these sort of 40, 50 yard passes to the head, you know, and eschewing all other options, and so suddenly you've.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
you know, you've got an issue where you're trying to play to a particular guy's strengths, but potentially at the sort of undermining other talents as you do it, and that's a tricky balance. And all I'm saying is I don't think Liverpool have quite got that right.
Tony?
And it's going to be.
I think it's a combination of things. I mean, I don't think Carroll's anywhere near where he should be at the moment. I mean, his movement wasn't good enough. He hasn't learned to use his physicality well enough. But also, I think.
Oh, sorry, convention, but there, the movement point. I just had to laugh. I watched Match of the Day. And like with the way they showed the I don't know if you saw it, but they broke it down like look at Carroll, great movement, look, he's pointing to where he wants the ball. Like, all right, problem solved.
Yeah, and you know it's and the centre of the Liverpool midfield when you play Charlie Adam and Lucas doesn't move the ball fast enough, it doesn't get it wide fast enough, so to get the best out of Carroll you got to get to the byline and you got to pull the ball back, you know, and they're not doing that. So I think it's a combination of those things. Dalglish knows it's an issue and he knows it's all down to him rather than Carroll actually to make this work. At the moment there's still a fair way away.
Ollie?
It doesn't really look like something that's going to go down in football folklore as one of the all-time great partnerships. I mean, you look at them and you think, well, yeah, one big one, one quick one, one slow one, which supposedly is half the battle with these partnerships. But it's never like that. It's more about sort of the intuition between the two and the sort of understanding that they've got and a partnership who, you know, two players who play to each other's strengths. I don't think they do that. And I could see ultimately Carroll being an option for Liverpool in certain games and an option on the bench certainly in every game that he doesn't start, rather than being the absolutely ideal partner for Suarez. And I think when he's cost $35 million, then that is an issue that is going to crop up. But I don't see those two being a fantastic partnership for years to come.
Final point about some of the stuff that was thrown on the pitch. I mean, obviously, Tony, I'm going to go to you because you've probably been to more of these fixtures than anybody else. But is this anything new? Is this something that the Premier League should take action over? Because I kind of get the sense, if it's a European game and the ball hits, a player for an English club, then, you know, everybody's out there on the warpath. But, you know, when it's a local derby, two Scouse clubs, am I wrong in this?
Well, I think relations between the two sets of fans has deteriorated over the years. I mean, it's never been the friendly derby of mythology. I mean, I've still got a lump on my shin where someone kicked me in 82 when when Liverpool scored the fifth there in the enclosure.
Should I ask you what you were doing in the Everton end?
That's what I got a ticket for.
Okay.
Well, I don't see that's an issue, but you know, it's got more and more poisonous since around 96, and you could see the nastiness there. I mean, I do think the vast majority of Evertonians are fine, but you know, you get the lunatics and the coin thrown at it. That's always gone on, and plastic bottles. I mean, you know, they're not real bottles.
But should the FA, the Premier League, take action?
Yeah, I think they probably should. I think they should, I think they should.
Should they fine Everton?
Yeah, I think they should. Yeah. And they won't have enough money to pay it. They've collected all the coins that were on the pitch to try and get transfer budgets.
Yeah, you've nicked my line. I saw someone tweeted that this morning that it's increased Everton's transfer budget by £3.76, which has effectively doubled it, Nathan.
I'm glad y'all can laugh at missiles being thrown on the pitch. Moving on to our debate. Carlos Tevez, of course, was a man in the news last week. Unless you were on another planet, you would have missed out on what happened when Manchester City played Bayern Munich. Roberto Mancini, the city manager, invited Tevez to come on as a substitute. Tevez misunderstood, although he can't tell us why he misunderstood or how it's possible that he misunderstood, and I am giving Tevez the benefit of the doubt with a statement he released the following day, and as a result, Mancini got very, very angry, shouted after the game and saying that he was finished at City and wouldn't be playing for them again as long as he was the manager, and City have opened an investigation into the case. I want to talk specifically about Tevez and then perhaps broaden it out to sort of the relationships between clubs and players. But Ollie, you were on top of this story. I want to start with Mancini's reaction. With hindsight, Was it wrong for him to go on this on this rant after the game? Should he just have kept his mouth shut and then maybe made the same point in a different way afterwards?
I think a lot of people applauded Mancini for saying what he did. But it's, I mean, one thing about Manchester City, perhaps more than any other club, in the Premier League at least, they have this sort of very corporate approach to these things. They have a human resources department which is overseeing this investigation with the club's lawyers. It's not, I mean, I was speaking to somebody last week, a manager who said that he suspended a player and banned them from the training ground for 2 weeks and fined them, and that there was no, this is 2 or 3 years ago, and that there was no quarrel at all from the player or from the club's board. But City have a way of doing things which is very unfootball-like and very thorough. And in view of that, I think Mancini has jumped the gun because they've got to go through this process. I don't think City can turn around and sack the guy, and I don't think they would particularly want it. So it's, I think he was premature in what he said in view of the kind of company he works for. That doesn't sound too corporate.
Yeah, if we can just establish that, because I've heard a lot of people, come out and say, oh, they could sack him and go after, get compensation for him the way Chelsea did with Mutu. Well, I think people are kind of missing the point that to sack him, you have to set the compensation value at a certain figure, which in Tevez's case would be absolutely enormous. And even assuming that after a 3-4 year legal battle, City won the case, the reality, even though Tevez is a very rich man, he probably does not have 50, 60 million pounds in liquid assets lying around. I mean, Mutu doesn't have the 14 million that he owes Chelsea. So, I mean, unless somebody strongly disagrees, I think we can knock that one on the head. Dicko, though, are you with Ollie in the fact that Mancini kind of painted himself into a corner a little bit?
Well, I mean, I guess for him it's difficult. Does he know what's come out on what's already emerged in public when he speaks? I mean, it's clearly already bleeding obvious that Dzeko's thrown an almighty wobbler, and probably fairly obvious that Tevez has refused. I mean, I guess he thinks it's already a public issue, so let's just deal with it head on. So I can totally understand where he's coming from, and I can also totally understand he'd reached the end of his tether. And has decided to make a decision, and to be honest, I can still see a way that, I mean, I think you wrote it last week, I think I can still see a way that Tevez plays for the club purely out of practicality, but I think that the decision has clearly been made in all their minds that he must leave at the earliest practical opportunity, and Mancini was entitled to say whatever he liked on that subject.
Tony?
You know what? If it wasn't for Keir Jarabshan and Carlos Tevez's history, I'd be sympathetic to the player. You know, these things happen in football. I talked to, last week, two ex-pros who refused to go on. They've had bust-ups with the manager, and then everything settles down, he carries on. You know, it happens all the time. You know, it's whether you want to be a drama queen about it, whether you want to make a big show of it. Ultimately, this could well cost Manchester City 15 or 20 million in terms of a fee for him. You know, because who's going to pay big money? They paid £47 million for Tevez, which Dicko broke the story. And they're not going to get anywhere near like that, because who's going to take a chance on him with his reputation? And it's driven his value down, and City will take a hit on it, probably.
And I think it's important to note in this, too, I was on the radio last week with Dave Whelan, who said, City are the one club in the world who can afford to lose money on Tevez and make an example of him, whatever else. But, the point is, though, it's financial fair play. Mm-hmm. And the reality is they can't go out and simply say, oh, we'll happily lose 100 million or 40 million or whatever it is on Tevez, but because they want to be in the Champions League. I think they probably owe it to their fans to be in the Champions League as well.
Yeah, and I think Platt was the sanest there last week, and all this emotion, sort of, he wouldn't come on, and it makes fans angry. It made me angry at the time, but Platt said, this is not a time for, for anger, it's a time for sane heads, and think about it the next day, and that's what City should have done.
Well, Tony talked there about how he's spoken to players who've refused to come on. I mean, I certainly know of cases. I remember Benny Carbone when he was at Sheffield Wednesday, and he was named to the substitutes bench by the evil Danny Wilson, and he just decided to just drive to the airport and fly home. I mean, he ended up coming back and continuing to play and score for Sheffield Wednesday, and then was sold, you know, later on to Aston Villa. And of course, the other case is Paul Scholes, who was one of the few people who said he, apart from Tony, said he sympathized a little bit with Carlos Tevez, because he refused to play in a League Cup game for Sir Alex Ferguson back in 2001. And, you know, the way Sir Alex handled it then was, you know, he made him apologize. He fined him 2 weeks' wages. And then Scholes went on to have the kind of career that he had at Old Trafford. Is it really that big a deal if a player refuses to come on as a substitute?
I think it is a big deal. I think it's, you know, it's a cardinal sin football-wise in certain ways. But I think what we have to recognise is that football clubs as employers tend to be very hypocritical and tend to apply double standards with this kind of thing. If Tevez had done this 2 years ago when he just arrived, when they were sort of very indulgent of him, or even last season, I don't think they would have reacted like this. If Rubinho had done it 3 years ago when he first arrived, I don't think they would have reacted in this way. Likewise, I mean, if it had been, say, Dwight York towards the end of his Manchester United career rather than Paul Scholes back in 2001, I dare say Sir Alex Ferguson would have reacted rather differently.
But isn't that logical and right? Because the club look out for their own best interests, right? It's the real world, right? If you're important, if you're valuable, you get treated differently than if you're a nuisance and irrelevant.
It is. You know, that is exactly right. But when you consider that City are taking a very corporate, legal and, as they say, fair route to this, I think they have to look at precedents. What did they do when Didi Hamann and Michael Ball refused to warm up at Hull a few years ago? And although they sound like blasts from the past City-wise, that was 3 years ago. It was under the Abu Dhabi regime. What happened then? Did they get fined? I don't know. They certainly didn't get sacked. So, I mean, I have zero sympathy with Tevez. Absolutely no sympathy whatsoever. But I do think City have to be sensible and fair about it. I don't think they can fine him 6, 7, 8 weeks' wages or whatever, or try to sack him or anything like that when all the precedents in their history and anybody else's history suggests that you know, that isn't the course of action you take.
The job of a manager is to manage, and Mancini didn't manage very well. You know, it should have been done behind closed doors. It should have, you know, he's got to get the best out of his squad, the best out of his players. You know, this has not helped City, and I don't think long term it'll help Mancini.
All right, so I'm assuming nobody buys Tevez's explanation that there's something else he can't talk about and there's miscommunications. We don't have to examine that. But Dicko, I want to throw it forward here. If he does leave on a permanent transfer, assuming City don't want to sell him to another Premier League club, I was like talking to an agent the other day, and he couldn't think of anybody in Europe that would take his wages, you know, plus a transfer fee of 15, 20 million. Do you see anybody who'd go on a limb? I mean, somebody other than the guy who owns Anji?
PSG. Why for him or why for them? I mean, they've got
why
money.
For them?
They're obviously trying to, well, they're trying to make a big splash.
For the same reason City signed them?
They want impact. They want goals. I mean, you know, and if you get him on a reasonably short-term the Qatari money, they get him on, probably just take him on any type of contract. They'll be pleased to have him. And I guess that is the problem. He's been hawked around. You know, when City signed him, they were so pleased to have him that they paid stupid money as a transfer fee and stupid money as a wages, and they imbalanced their relationship from the start. And that's probably what would happen at someone like PSG, where he'd come in as the big star.
They could have signed him over the summer if they wanted, if they had any interest whatsoever in him.
Yeah, but the fees just dropped, as Tony quite rightly says. The fees just dropped about 15 million. Man City were trying to hold out for 40 plus in the summer. Now the fee now has gone down to, you know, they'll be happy to get 20 plus. So if I was someone like PSG, I could easily see how they'd be tempted into it. Now obviously, that's one for starters.
I don't know if there's any direct flights from Malaga to Buenos Aires, though, because I know, you know, obviously that's a, because, you know, I suppose Malaga, but I mean, we are talking about situations like that, or I'm assuming somebody in the Gulf, or, you know,
one of those Russian oligarchs.
Carlos Tevez, Samuel Eto'o dream partnership at Anji, managed by Roberto Carlos.
But again, that's the thing. They'll go to a club that's so desperate to sign that they can get terms where, you know, if it could be a short-term deal, because then a short-term deal runs out and they can get him as a free agent and resume the whole joyful third party ownership situation. So the whole thing stinks and is a depressing statement about where football's at, and as has been written a few times since, you know, after the mutiny, the bounty, because, you know, the winners, you know, in this, certainly financially, will be Tevez and his lovely handlers. Doesn't that make you smile and funny?
Yeah, I'm really not sure that Tevez is going to be a winner in this. I don't think what he did was premeditated. And yeah, he will be a rich man like he was a rich man before, but he has seriously damaged his reputation even further. And I don't know.
I don't disagree with that, and I'm not saying he's a winner in the sporting sense, and he's going to fill his cabinet with lots of trophies. But we sort of start asking what he does want from the game, to be honest.
No, it's a fair point. We're going to end this with a little prediction about where Carlos Tevez will be playing his football in 6 months' time. I'm going to start with you, Ollie.
They haven't been mentioned yet, but I wouldn't be surprised to see Real Madrid come in.
Ooh, alone, yeah?
Yeah.
Adebayor Mark II, as somebody here suggested once before. Dicko?
No, I was going to lob in as well and be surprised. I mean, I think you'll have choice of Russia, Dubai, Paris, Madrid. You're better off getting Kiedza Repcin on the phone. He'll choose.
Tony, West Ham perhaps?
I think Jose's ego will lead him to think, yeah, we'll get him over here.
Wow, I'd really be shocked if that was to happen. Time now for what I like to call quick hits. Manchester United drop points at home to Basel in the Champions League. Then they have to huff and puff to overcome an impressive Norwich side, and they eventually win 2-0. Tony, is this a sign that some of the accolades we've been giving the champions are somewhat premature?
Well, I think accolades were overexcitable. They look wide open to me, and they look to have loads of flaws. But you know what? The thing is, there'll be people like Norwich 2-0 all the time after playing badly and struggling. So, you know, that's what United do. You know, they'll be there or thereabouts, but they're not that good, and they'll be found out in Europe.
Ah, hear that. Real simple, Ollie. If you were an Indian chicken magnate, would you sack Steve Keane right about now?
I think I probably would. I hate to advocate the sacking of managers, but I don't see this one working out. And I think if I was an Indian chicken magnate buying a football club, I wouldn't decide on the basis of an agent's advice after 6 weeks to dump an experienced manager and put in a coach who's never managed at the top level before. I think that was the mistake, and I think they have to rectify this if they want to stay up.
My prediction is that they fly him over to India for that friendly Friday, and then he doesn't know it's a one-way ticket, and they just kind of leave him there. Steve McLaren is no more as Nottingham Forest manager. Dicko, you're probably the biggest admirer he has out of all of us here. At this rate, do you see him back in the Premier League ever? By the way, this is the Barclays Premier League I'm talking about, not the Indian Premier League, since we're continuing with the cricket theme there.
Yeah, so no time soon. I expect he'll be back in a top division, quite possibly a Dutch one. He did have an option to make oodles and oodles of money in Turkey, I think it was, this summer. So he'll be back in the top league, but I don't suspect it will be anywhere near these shores. Great shame, actually, because it wasn't like they said in the brochure.
It certainly wasn't. You do feel kind of bad for him.
Yeah, Gab, here's one for you. Both Milan teams got stuffed this weekend. Who's got the bigger problems?
Well, I actually think that it's AC Milan who have the bigger problems. AC Milan, of course, lost 2-0, absolutely blitzed by a Juventus side that looked possessed. I think they're looking static. I think their best players just keep getting hurt all the time. And I'm starting to think that Allegri won the title through smoke and mirrors last year. Inter Milan, on the other hand, blitzed at home 3-0 by Napoli. They've got a major recriminations to make against the referee. Also, they were missing Wesley Sneijder, and Napoli are a very, very good side. That's all we've got time for this week, but you can go to www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find all your news, your gossip, your analysis, and you can also follow us on Twitter. I'm on Twitter, at Mark Carty. Tony, you're...
Tony Evans Times.
There you go, Tony Evans Times. Not difficult to remember. And also, remember, we've got a live game podcast show coming up. It's a special one-off. You're going to be there, right, Tony?
Yeah, I am, yeah.
And of course, I'll be there too, and we'll have Paddy Barkley, so we'll enjoy seeing Tony cross swords with old Paddy once again.
We're going to arm wrestle.
There you go, an arm wrestling extravaganza over the top. Oh, wow, wow. And I'm sure that Tom Dart will be there running a little betting ring on the side. And the date of that, of course, October 27th. You can go to the Times website for more information. Again, thanks for joining us. Till next week. Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.